Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the session. So how many of you came on my sort of what's new in 2012 AD? Okay, so you'll know that I've been reading this article about how belly laughs really improve your concentration. So in this article, it also said that a really deep yawn really helps, but you have to put your hands in the air to do it. So I thought we'd start the session with actually trying that. So all you need to do, you raise your hands, take a huge deep breath, and then yawn. Ready? Ah. How was that? Good? Let's do it again. Deep breath. Ah. Right. Now we're ready. What are we talking about? Yes, I remember now. We've come to talk about running your Active Directory in the Windows Azure Fabric. Now, how many of you read the outline for this session? Oh, well, not too bad. So you will have seen that what I want to do is also set the scene as to the Windows Azure Active Directory and really just differentiate the two, because that's really important. You know, you say, oh, we must put our AD in the Azure platform, but you need to make sure you're doing it for the right reasons. So what I'm going to cover off is I'm going to actually look at, first of all, contrasting Windows AD with Windows Azure AD, and then look at the reasons as to why you might deploy an AD into the Azure Fabric, design considerations and options, and some caveats as we go through there. And then I want to give you a sort of rough step-by-step guide as to how we do this. Now, how many of you have deployed a VM into Windows Azure? Okay, so not very many hands, probably about 20 hands, less than 25% of the audience. I'm not going to be able to tell you everything about putting VMs into Azure and everything else. I will explain a lot as we go along. Those things that actually impact deploying domain controllers. So you'll need to go off and do a step-by-step guide to putting a VM up there before you actually will be able to put your DCs. But I will cover the important things, re-domain controllers. What is Windows Azure? Windows Azure is a platform on which you've got compute capability, you've got storage, and you've also got SQL database. In terms of compute, you may have heard of web roles and worker roles. I'm going to refer to those as Azure applications. They're specifically crafted to run in Azure. And then we've got websites and we've got virtual machines, and that's really the focus of how we use these virtual machines. Those came out, the websites and the virtual machines came out in 2012. In terms of storage, we've got blobs, tables, and queues. The one we're interested in is the blob storage, blob as in binary large object. And that's where we're going to put our virtual hard disks. That's where our virtual hard disks are going to be stored within the Azure platform. Then you've got Windows Azure Services, and sitting up there, there's a whole bunch of building blocks that help you put things together. And one of those building blocks is the Windows Azure Active Directory. And we'll have to find out exactly what that is. How do we manage this lot? Well, we have a portal, so you can do an awful lot through sort of using the GUI portal. You've got APIs, and in terms of APIs, you can use PowerShell. You can use Windows Server Tools, System Center, etc., to actually get up there. And you can also do on-prem development and just deploy. But the on-prem development is more about deploying Windows Azure applications. Right? And as I say, we're focusing on virtual machines here. So Active Directory now has become an umbrella. All right. So Active Directory, as we all know and love, has sort of moved up a bit. And then we have our Active Directory we all know and love, right, which we look after, we manage the infrastructure, we manage the data that's in there. It gives us services. In terms of authentication, it gives us Kerberos, it gives us NTLM and V2 now. And then you've got sort of lightweight directory services, certificate services, and so on. And then you have the Windows Azure Active Directory, right? And the Windows Azure Active Directory is completely managed by Microsoft in terms of the infrastructure. You manage the data. But in terms of looking after anything else, nothing to do with you. Right? It's designed to be highly available, highly reliable. In terms of services, today we have the directory services, which is where we store user identity and attributes about those users. And then in terms of authentication, no Kerberos, no NTLM, it's all about federated authentication. So WS Federation, OAuth, etc., SAMLP, and expect that list to get longer and longer. And then there's another component at the moment, which is the Access Control Service. And what the Access Control Service does for us is it allows us to broker identity from different identity sources. Right? As I say, those are the two components currently today, but expect to see more in the future. All right. So now, when someone says, you know, it's a great thing, if you're a bit of one-upmanship, you know, someone says, oh, yes, we run Active Directory, and you say, which one? And they look at you in a strange way. What do you mean, which one? Well, is it WAD or is it WAD? Come on, mouse. Wake up, mouse. Okay, so what I want to do is just very briefly look at that. The Windows Azure Active Directory, if you have Office 365 and you have an Office 365 identity store, you have a Windows Azure Active Directory. So really, it's just the latest release of the Office 365 directory. Just to give some bit of information, so it runs in 14 data centers, which is sort of pretty much spread across the globe. And in a recent 90-day period, it actually processed 65 billion authentication requests with 99.97% availability. So, you know, it's doing really well. It's a very mature directory. So if you already have an account, you have a Windows Azure Active Directory account. Otherwise, you can sign up for a Windows Azure Active Directory. And you become a tenant within Microsoft space. So how do we use it? There it is, sitting up there. There you are as a tenant. So what we can do is we can access it through the management portal. There's a whole set of REST APIs, so we can add to it, we can read it, etc. And then there's a graph API set, and a graph API allows us to bring out the hierarchy that exists in there. So if you want to find out, you know, John and John's manager and, you know, the manager of the John, you know, and up the hierarchy, you can do that very easily as well. What do we do with it? Well, we can synchronize users from our own AD. So there's a synchronization tool for doing that. So we can push our own users up into there. Plus, we can authenticate to pretty much anything you like, provided it's using federated authentication. So you can actually manage your Azure subscription using a Windows Azure Active Directory identity. Office 365, your apps, partner apps. Now, the real key is, once you start using federation, where are your apps? It doesn't matter. They could be on-prem, they could be in one cloud, or another cloud, or another cloud. You can move them around, and you can keep authentication going. And that's the real benefit of using federated identity. When you sign up, you will get an account which is sort of John Smith at onmicrosoft.com, but you can add your own domains. So you can actually add your own domains. So you can actually use logons that everyone's familiar with. Now, if we look at the authentication flow, there's our user over there, hits a claims aware application. Claims aware application says, you're not authenticated, and sends back a message which has a redirect on it, which redirects you up to the authentication provider that application trusts. So here, the application is trusting WAD. It says redirected to WAD. We do an authentication there, returns a security token, and that, if you're familiar with federation, on federation you can put anything you like on the security token. But this security token is very minimal, right? It just basically has an identifier for the user. And then that token gets returned to the app, and the app can then go and retrieve anything it needs from the directory itself. And it can have a key which gives it read access only, or it can have a key that gives it read-write access. And then we return the cookies from the page and we're authenticated. If you look at it working with your own users from your own AD, then what happens is we hit the Claimsware application. Once again, we're bounced up to WAD, and WAD effectively does a home realm discovery. It discovers who you are, all right? So you put in your username, and immediately what will happen is it can look you up and say, ah, yeah, okay, I can authenticate you. Oh no, you're a federated user. You need to go over there. And this can be an ADFS server in your own environment. So now you're authenticated using your own AD credentials. We authenticate, return the security token, return it back to WAD. WAD then converts it as it needs to, it processes the token, it returns it back to the user, and then the user presents that to the application. At which point, the application goes off to WAD to retrieve full information about that user. Well, to be able to do that, if it's one of your users from your own AD, what we need to do is arrange synchronization. So we do directory synchronization. So even though a user is actually being authenticated by your own AD, then we just synchronize that user up there. No password, synchronize up, because the authentication's done here, all right? We just take it up, and then we can get that information. Okay, what does the access control service do for us? It's, as I said, its simplest way is think of it as a sort of, it's an identity broker, and it allows you to very easily log on using a Live ID, Google, Yahoo, Facebook, Windows ADFS, wherever that might be, and also Windows Azure. We look at that, what actually happens is the user accesses the relying party, and it could be an application here, and we then get bounced up to the access control service, and the access control service passes you to the list of identity providers. You authenticate with the appropriate identity provider, returns a token, which then gets passed back to the access control service, processed up there, passed back to the user, who in turn passes it back to the application, and you are authenticated. So let's do a little demo of this, and just switch screens, and this thing has finally logged me out, so let me just log in. And what I'm going to do here is actually bring up, because I'm already logged into Azure, I'm just going to bring up in private browsing. And I'm going to go, notice I'm going to xts-sp.cloudapp.net. I am going up to a SharePoint server running in Windows Azure. And where do I end up? I end up being asked, would I like to log in with a Live ID, a Google ID, or an Azure AD ID? So what's actually happened is the application has pushed me back and said, look, you need to authenticate with this guy. And I've been sent up to ACS. And ACS is now saying, yeah, okay, you're here. Who would you like to authenticate with? All right. And so I could choose a Windows Live ID, for instance, and I'd be bounced off to Live ID. Or I could choose a Google ID, and I'm bounced off to log in with Google. Or I could choose Azure AD, and I'm bounced off to log in at Azure, and let's just show it. So I've got an account up there. And now I'm logging into SharePoint, and where is SharePoint? Happens to be in the Azure cloud, but it could be on-prem, it could be anywhere, all right? And now I've used and actually brokered this identity across. So that is the Windows Azure Active Directory today, and that's what it offers you. Now, when we come, we need to bear that in mind. So if you're putting Active Directory into the cloud for authentication purposes, you may have to ask yourself, is that the right route to go? In the short term, it might be, all right? But in the long term, you might want to start thinking about authenticating and using Federation to do your authentication. So what we're talking about now is running your AD in virtual machines, right? A totally different story, right? So why do we do it? Well, some applications that you're running, you may decide that you put applications up there that need an AD, and they need an AD to actually operate. You might say, well, I'm going to deploy lots of VMs, and what would be actually great is if I could manage them with group policy. So you put an AD up there so that you can manage them with group policy across all your VMs in the Azure cloud. You might want to use your own Windows Update service as well. So anything in terms of management, you may decide that an AD is a good thing to have. You may decide that actually you really like the Windows Server 2012 unified managements, where you can manage through one machine all of your machines, and you want to do it for that reason. So there are two options. You can go for a hybrid deployment, or you could go for a cloud-only deployment. So if you go for a hybrid deployment, why might you want to do that? Well, you may have cloud services that need to access on-premise data. You may decide that actually what we really want, we don't want to use Federation, and we want our users to log in to those servers that we're running up in the cloud, right, using Windows credentials from our own on-premise AD, but we don't want to use Federation. Federation's one step too far for us today. But you could, in theory, talk from your machine up here across the VLAN down to the machine down here, okay, your DCs. Problem is, logon latency might well be an issue. So you put an AD up there. So now you've got your on-premise AD up into the Azure cloud. But do think about Federation. All right, and think about that as maybe a route forward if you're thinking about the authentication. Well, you go cloud only. Why do we go cloud only? For any of the reasons above, all right, where we want to manage via group policy, etc. So, in terms of design considerations, we have to say our DCs are going to be running on VMs. Right? How many of you run your DCs on virtual machines today? Okay, I would say that's a good, almost half the audience. Your DIT and your SysVol must be on non-cache data drives. That's really, really important. When you create a virtual machine in Azure, it will be a cache drive that the operating system, right, says be a deferred write that actually happens before, you know, it says, you do a write in the OS, and it says, oh, yeah, you've succeeded, great. But actually, it's sitting somewhere before it actually gets written into your virtual machines. Right? What's really important is your DIT and your SysVol. If you say it's written and you get the thumbs up, the write successful, it is actually on the VHD. So it's very, very important to remember that. It'll work perfectly if you don't do it until something happens. And then your database will be in a mess. We need to consider IP addressing and name resolution. All right, there's some gotchas around IP addressing. We need to work out if our DCs should be GCs. Should they be RODCs? Should we be using separate forests with trusts? What happens if we want to, for fault tolerance, we want to put part of our AD in one part of the world and a part of our AD in another part of the world. How do we manage replication between those ADs? And then we need to think about optimizing deployment for network traffic. So first of all, VMs. And I thought it'd be very useful, especially if you've been listening to the keynotes and the announcements that's going on, I thought it'd be very useful to actually just clarify machine state. Running, so you've got a running VM. What happens is it's the VM's running in Azure, and you're being charged for the compute. And the amount of how much you get charged depends on the VM size. Okay? Guest OS shutdown. So this is where you actually go into the guest system and shut it down as normal. And you're still charged for the running VM instance. So if you think, oh, I'll save a bit of money, I'll shut down my VMs from the guest, you're not going to save a penny. Then deleted. When you delete, what actually happens is the VM is deallocated from the Windows Azure Fabric. So those IPs it's been given, all the other bits, the network cards, they're deallocated from the VM. All right, so the VM has gone completely. But the VHD can still be sitting in Azure Storage, and you will still be charged for storage for that VHD. Now, what's happened is there is a new, and this is new in Windows Azure now, you have the option to shut down. Right? I wish they'd used a different name, because people get so confused between, oh, I shut down my VM. And is it the OS you shut down, or is it the Azure VM you shut down? This is your shutting down the Azure VM. It'd be nice if they said deallocate or something like that. Because what will happen, it will go into this stop state, and in brackets, you will see deallocated. And what's happened, it's actually been pulled out of the fabric. Right? It's a bit like you've deleted the thing but left the VM. But you now have an option of hitting start, and what it does is it automatically reallocates it and starts the VM up again. But while you're in this deallocated state, you are not being charged for compute. You will be charged for your VHD storage, all right? And it's really just the automated process. If I delete a VM, deletes the virtual machine, you can hang on to the VHD, and then I could rebuild the VM using that VHD. And what this has done, it's automated that process. And it's designed for, you know, you've got dev and test labs, and you have all these dev and test labs. Previously, if you wanted to save money, you had to delete all your VMs and go through the pain of rebuilding them. All right? Now what you can do is you can shut them down and then start them up when you're ready. So dev test labs, demand burst, disaster recovery, those are the sort of scenarios it's designed for. The core of Azure, up until fairly recently, It was a modified version of the hypervisor. It is now running on the true Server 2012 hypervisor. And that you have to bear in mind that one of the things the hypervisor does now is it exposes a VM generation ID GUID. So with a domain controller, all right, on promotion, what it does is it grabs the VM generation ID GUID, right? And it's constantly saying, am I on the same, is the GUID that's being exposed, is actually exposed through the ACPI BIOS. Is the GUID exposed the same as the one that I've stored in the directory? And if it ever detects it's not, it says, ah, a snapshot must have been applied, or the VM's been recreated. And immediately, the DC assumes that it needs to do an AD restore. And in that restore, it changes its database invocation GUID ID. It deallocates the RID pool. But the one thing we need to consider here is it does a non-authoritative restore of sysvol. That's the one to remember. So when does this VM generation ID change? It changes during service healing. What's service healing? Okay, so you have a rack of machines in the Microsoft data center, and the rack falls over for some reason, or your VM dies, the actual server it's running on. No problem. Microsoft will do service healing for you. It will basically fire up another VM, attach your VHDs, and off you go. You don't know it's happened, except, of course, your DC's up, but it's noticed the VM generation ID's changed. So it goes into this little Active Directory restore mode. I'll come back in a little bit more detail in a second. Host servicing, what's that? Host servicing is you are responsible from the OS upwards for updates, everything else. That's your job, right? They're responsible for the platform below it. So they need to service that. They'll take your VM offline, because actually what they do, they don't service your VM. What they'll do is they'll chuck away your VM and attach it to a new VM that's already been updated. So it fires up a new VM for you, which has already been updated, and then they update this server. So that's the host servicing, and then shut down and start operations for those development environments. Right? If any DC that goes through that goes into this AD restore process, if all the DCs are affected at the same time, what will happen is they'll all go, oh, I need to do an AD restore. No problem. Boom, boom, boom. They've all gone into AD restore. AD will replicate beautifully, except Sysvol is non-authoritative on this server, non-authoritative on this server, non-authoritative on this server, and they will all sit there saying, where's an authoritative Sysvol? There isn't one. All right? So that's the situation we need to avoid. And the way we achieve that is for production cloud-only AD deployments, we must make sure that we use this thing called an availability set. And what an availability set is, we put our DCs into an availability set, and it says these DCs cannot all be being serviced or healed at the same time. Right? And so what they'll do is they will distribute DCs, or VMs, if you like, in an availability set across different fault and update domains. A fault domain is effectively a rack, because a rack could lose its power, it could lose the switch at the top, right? And an update domain is they split up and they say, we'll update this one, right? We'll get that updated, and 10 minutes later, we'll update the next one. So if you're distributed across update domains, then it guarantees that you will have availability. So sort of recommendation is basically, probably if you're doing a cloud only for production, is to deploy 3 DCs. So in the unlikely event that there's a double fault domain failure, then 2 DCs are going to be, you will be able to recover from that. But do make sure, because with DCs in our own environment, right? Hopefully, for those who do virtualization of their DCs, they don't put them all on the same host system. Right? They've got them distributed. So if one DC goes down, who cares? But here, we've got the potential, if we don't tell it to use an availability set, we've got the potential they're all going to be sitting in the same rack. Right? They'll be sitting on different servers, but all in the same rack, and that rack could go out in one hit. Right? And then we're into this situation where we have a non-authoritative sysvol. The other thing is, if you're in a hybrid environment, question. If you're in a cloud, very, very good question. And if you hold on one second, you see, sometimes there are good questions, and then there are absolutely excellent questions. And an excellent question is when I've got the answer on the next slide. So the question was, what happens if you only have one DC? Okay. If you're in a hybrid environment, then obviously hybrid, you are connected, right, down to on-prem, and on-prem servers can be authoritative for the ones in the cloud. Okay. But you need to take this into account for your design. For development environments, use a single DC, right? Because a single DC, VM generation GUIs changed, who cares? I don't need to go into AD restore mode. I am the only DC. Right? Now, if you require multiple DCs in a dev environment and you are using the new shutdown, right? And I've caveated that, shutdown refers to the new Windows Azure feature. It does not mean shutting down the guest OS. So if you go and shut down the guest OS, it'll come up VMG and you restart it. The generation ID doesn't change. It's when you use the Windows Azure shutdown that the generation ID changes. And what will happen is if you've got multiple DCs, you shut them all down, you start them up, fantastic, they all come up, they all start replicating AD, but sysfol is non-authoritative across them all. If you do need that, then you will have to do an authoritative restore of sysfol. It's actually very simple. And if you're familiar with sys, how many of you have done the D2, D4 flags, the BER flags? Okay, lots of hands. How many of you have done it with 2012 sysfol replication? Yeah, okay, one hand went up there. It's anyway, just have a look at the knowledge base articles. So just bear that in mind, multiple DCs in a dev test environment, you will need to do an authoritative restore. So did that answer your question, sir? Good. So should the DC be a GC? Single domain environment, cloud-only environment, absolutely 100%, no question about it, because there's no hardship in it being a GC. It's got all the data already. The question comes is if you're in a hybrid, multi-domain environment, and the answer is probably yes. The problem is in a hybrid, multi-domain environment, right, you will have replication traffic to your GC. However, if you don't have a GC in Windows Azure, you could end up with authentication failures. Because as part of the authentication, if you're putting your DC up there so that we can authenticate against it, then at authentication times, the GC needs to be found. All right? So what we could end up doing is starting the authentication, go off and find the GC, we got network latency, or even the network's down, right? And we can't authenticate in a timely manner. You will find some applications are very, very picky on the authentication time. So if you're authenticating across the WAN, right, it can actually, the application can fail because the authentication's taken too long. So be very careful. And you will need to do some testing. Obviously, there's additional replication to manage your GC up there, but with it up there, you can make sure that the authentication is timely. And you can authenticate if the link is down. The other thing is, if you have huge amounts of GC replication, because you're just adding and taking away huge amounts of data all the time, then what you could look at is using universal group membership caching. So we can implement that up in the cloud, which means, because all we need to do at authentication time is get the universal group membership, and that's held in the GC. So you can actually cache that. So again, you've got to factor that in your design. Should it be an RODC? And here, we have to think of why were RODCs invented? RODCs are there to basically deploy at non-secure branch offices, and that's what they were designed for. And if you think of Windows Azure as a non-secure branch office, maybe you shouldn't be using Windows Azure or any cloud service. So you need to make sure you are happy with security. And if you think about it, for an awful lot of companies, the data center security up in Azure or other cloud services, for that matter, is going to be a whole lot better than your security. Right? So really, it shouldn't be a security concern for you, but you will need to go through a security assessment and make sure it isn't a security concern. By deploying an RODC, you actually just end up in trouble, or can end up in trouble. One of the things with an RODC, of course, you can restrict which attributes are replicated up there. But, of course, there are known and also unknown application compatibility issues. So you will need to do a lot of testing. A very classic example of that was originally when you wrote a printer into the AD, what would happen is down here in the branch office with an RODC, right, what would happen is it would say, oh, I want to write to you. And he says, oh, you can't write to me. Here's an LDAP referral. And up it goes to a writable DC. And then it just said, oh, I better confirm the write into the Active Directory. So it would read this guy. All right? And then he'd be reading this guy and said it wasn't written. So he'd go up and have another go at writing and write it up here again. And he'd be reading it down here. And until the thing replicated, this thing would just be spinning round and round in circles. And that's the type of issue you can have with RODCs. So if you want to use one, think very hard about, you know, why am I actually doing this? Because recommendation is not to do it. But if you do really, really, really decide RODCs are for you in the Azure cloud, make sure you test for application compatibility. So separate forest with trust. Yes, you can do that. You can create a new forest in the cloud, and you can establish a trust with on-premise. So the pros of that is there's no AD replication across the VPN between the cloud and you. Okay. Security, you have two administrative boundaries, one around the cloud and one on-prem. So you've got that. You can also, you could use selective authentication, can be enabled to individual corporate servers. So we can actually have selective authentication down here. The cons of this are that we increase authentication traffic across the VPN, and you may hit this logon latency problem, where you're trying to authenticate, and it takes too long across the VPN. And if the VPN's down, you can't authenticate. So again, you have to ask yourself, why am I doing this? Well, I absolutely need to authenticate users, and I absolutely need to maintain security boundaries. What's the answer? I absolutely need to authenticate users and security boundaries? Answer is, don't put your AD up in there. All right? Use Federation to authenticate those users. And then you've got your security boundaries completely. You're looking after your own nice, secure corporate network. And you could say, okay, I'll deploy a cloud-only DC because I need it for group policy and all the rest of the stuff. So I'm deploying a SharePoint farm up here. So you deploy an AD to support that SharePoint farm, and you say, actually, do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to use Federation to the SharePoint farm and manage it through that. Now, if you do geo-distributed DCs across different data centers, you cannot today, and I say today, and this is something, when you're talking about Azure, you always need to say today, because things change at a rate of knots. There's a lot of improvements, a lot of additional functionality, and it goes through sort of preview and then goes into production. So, you know, you go to the portal and say, oh, I'll show you how to do this, and you what? The portal's all changed. It does change on a fairly regular basis. So if I want to have a situation where I've got DC1, DC2 from single AD, corporate AD, and I want to replicate, the replication is going to go from DC1 through the VPN1 and then to DC2 through VPN2. So it's going to come across. Right? But actually, to be honest, is it a big deal? Because where are the changes being made? They're being made on CorpNet. Right, so they'll be pushed out across. So it's not a huge deal anyway. The other thing you need to do is absolutely 100%, if you're going to have a hybrid situation, absolutely make sure that you define your AD sites and services subnets correctly. Because obviously it influences replication, but equally well, it influences client affinity. And what you don't want to do is have clients thinking their closest DC is up there. Also, make sure that you set your site link costs appropriately. So what you don't want is cloud DCs suddenly becoming closest sites. So, you know, if you have a problem with DCs on this site, which is in your corporate network, you don't suddenly want thinking, closest site is up here. So you need to make sure that you set those link costs. And you don't want to enable notify replication on-premise between on-premise sites and the cloud. Reason being is there could be a lot of traffic happening with the notifications all the time, and of course, you're going to be charged for it. All right? So it's better to not have it switched on. and turn on the highest on your bridgehead servers, just enable highest compression. I mean, the highest compression eats a bit more CPU time, but actually these days with CPUs the size they are and the servers the size they are in terms of horsepower, then it's not a big issue turning up the compression. Okay, so what do we need to do this and get our Windows Azure VMs up there? Number one, we create an Azure virtual network for your VMs. This is really important. I can deploy a VM into Azure. I don't even have to think about a network. Right? It will just sit up there, and I can access it. It's somewhere in the cloud. And I can access it through a public URL. Right? But when we're building this infrastructure, we need to create a virtual network where we sit our DCs, where we sit our maybe our web servers, we sit our SQL servers, or anything else you want to use, right? So that's key number one. You need to create a storage account to hold the OS and the data VHDs. So let's just have a quick look at a storage account and what it looks like. So I have my Azure portal. Yeah, actually, this is very interesting. This is a very key to getting it right and not upsetting your American colleagues is to pronounce it correctly. So if you say after me, as we are going on holiday, can you say that? As we are going on holiday. It's as you are going on holiday. Got it wrong. As you are going on holiday. And then shorten it. As you're going on holiday. That's it. That's the pronunciation. Okay, so this is my portal. This is my dev portal. And if I have a look down here at storage, what I've got is this thing called XTS 101. And I look at the dashboard on that. I can see three ways of getting at it. What's the size like at the back? Can you see those URLs or not? On the back row? Yes, no, a bit dodgy. Oh well. Better? Okay, so you remember I said you've got blob storage, you've got table storage, you've got queues, right? Tables and queues, forget those. They're to do with worker roles and web roles and basically Windows Azure applications. What we're interested in here is blob storage. Notice there is a URL. It's a public URL. Okay, which in itself means that actually you can get to this storage from absolutely anywhere. There are manage access keys. There are a set of keys that allow you to gain access to this. So if you're outside of the Azure fabric, outside the Azure platform, you can gain access to this storage, but you need those keys. So bear that in mind, because if you've got someone, an administrator, who knows the key, and you sack him, he can still have access. So you need to regenerate the keys on a fairly regular basis. Right, and especially if someone actually gets fired and they've had access to those keys, regenerate them. Very easy to do, you just click on here, but I don't actually want my keys recorded, so I'm not going to show you. Okay, if we go over to containers over here, this is my blob storage, there's my VHDs. I'm running currently four virtual machines. I'm running two jump servers, and I'm running two domain controllers. And why am I running two jump servers? Well, just so I don't say, let's have a look at the jump server and find it's going through an update or service healing. So I've got those across an availability set. So if I attempt to go to jump one, and it can't get there because Microsoft are busy doing something, I can go to jump two. Right? And again, I've got a couple of DCs. Now, in terms of my storage, there's my operating system VHDs. And for those at the back row, you can see we've got those at 127 meg, and then I've got some 10 gig storage, right? And that is where I've got the DIT for my DIT and sysvol for my DCs. And if we go over to the VHDs themselves, let's just get back there. So if we go to the virtual machines, we can see we got DC1, DC2, jump one, jump two. SP2010, that is SharePoint. That's the SharePoint I accessed earlier, okay? If we look at the disks associated with this, and again, let's just do that. And what you can see is that we've got here, DC. This is attached to DC1, it's read, write. That is the operating system disk. That one's attached to DC1, and it's none. So it is a no caching on that, and that is really important that our, you know, our DIT sysfol is on a non-cache drive. And you can see that's repeated for DC2, and then we've got read-write disks for the two jump servers. Okay, I just wanted to quickly show you the storage. Oh, no, actually, I'll tell you what I will do. Why don't we do this before I switch back? I've actually, there I am already attached. XTS101, I'm actually attached, and if I go in there, I can actually see, I've got an image up there, which is all very exciting. It's a blob, and there you go. It's called a blob, and it looks like a blob. But actually, the important one, we were here. Excuse me, Peter. Sorry, I thought I'd exited that. Come on. and I can get to my VHDs here. And this is, so I'm effectively on-prem or anywhere, right? But I do have the storage key to allow me to do this. There are lots of really useful tools for getting at storage. There's Azure Storage, Cloudy Explorer, all sorts of things. So just if you, I particularly like Azure Storage Explorer, but there are other tools that have a sort of complete, it looks like, you know, File Explorer for Azure, so you can actually cut and paste or just drag and drop between on-prem and the cloud. Okay. So we create our storage, and then what we do is we deploy the VM and the OS and attach a data disk. And the VMs absolutely need to be in the same availability set for our DCs. And again, non-cache data disk. And then you install ADDS, directory services, and you do your promotion. And of course, you can drive this whole thing with PowerShell. So I can use a very simple bit of Azure PowerShell to create my VM, create a disk, attach the disk, and then I'm all ready to roll with this thing, and then I can have a little bit more PowerShell, installs the role, and then finally installs AD for me. So I can automate the whole process. Okay, VNet, the Windows Azure Virtual Network. What we do is we create it using private address ranges, and you can subnet it. So I can say I'd like the 10.20 as my VNet up there, and 10.20.10 is one network, 10.20.20 is another network, and so on. And then VMs and other services connect to the virtual network. Why do I say other services? Other services could actually be your Windows Azure applications. And actually, I've mentioned them a number of times. To just give you a quick example of a worker role. A worker role is an application developed, which is, a web role. It's an application you develop, which is effectively a web service. And the main advantage of using that over a VM, I can very rapidly scale it. So I can have one instance of it, which is not a great idea because I need two for the SLA. But let's say you're building a website for selling concert tickets. Most of the time people browse it until you put those tickets on sale, and then suddenly you get a huge ramp up of demand. So very quickly you can scale those web roles up. So again, when you're thinking about the Azure platform, don't just think about running VMs. Think about using web roles and worker roles. And that's why I say other services there. So I can attach a web role onto this virtual network. Virtual machines can connect on-premise, and we do that through a VPN gateway. You will need to bring, Azure has DNS, but but you'll need to bring your own DNS if you are going to put AD up there to support SRV records and so on. So the way we create this thing is we basically say new virtual network, and we choose, here in this case, I've choose 10.30.0.0/16, and then I've subnetted it, you know, .1, .2, .3 with a /24. And then what I do is I define a subnet to support the gateway. If I want to connect to on-prem, don't have to connect to on-prem, but if I want to, I need a subnet for the gateway to be on. And then what I'll need to do is define the, well, specify the address, the public IP of my VPN device, right? And you will need to tell Azure what networks you have on your own premises. And that way it can set up the routing appropriately. Right? So here I would be telling it, let's say I was the 10.80 network, I would be telling 10.80. And then I can install the actual gateway, and then I've got a gateway down to my corporate network. And I've declared a public IP there. Okay, I meant to look at that now. So let's switch back to our demo machine, and let's actually go back over to this time to the virtual networks. So coming down here, we go to network. I've got a couple of networks. I'll just go, just show you the creation process. So what you do is you give it a name. And then it says affinity group. What's an affinity group? An affinity group, so let's just cancel that. And let's go down to settings. And let's go affinity groups. OK. You can host, right, in certain regions. So actually, the best idea there is to go and add, and we go new affinity group. We'll call it one, actually. You can host in a region, Western Europe. There might be 3 or 4 data centers in Western Europe. You can host in Southeast Asia. There might be a couple of data centers out there, all right? So what you need to do, you can't control which data center you're going to be in. But what you can do is create an affinity group. And if everything is in the same affinity group, all those things will be held together in the same data center. So your virtual network, your virtual machines, your storage. Because if you don't do it, what can happen is your storage could be over there and your virtual machine's running over here in this data center. You could say, oh, I chose to deploy in, I don't know, North Europe. But in fact, what's happened is your storage is in North Europe data center 1 and your virtual machines are in North Europe data center 2. So we need an affinity group. And you simply just give it a name and you choose the region. So let's cancel that and let's go back to networks. So I can go to virtual networks here and I go, new, that's it. And we go to custom create, and I say, give it a name, we'll call it OneNet, how about that? Let's host it in Azure Services, fine. DNS, we don't know the IP address of our servers until we've deployed them, all right? And that's a one caveat, and I will come back on that. In terms of how would we like to go, well, we can go to a VPN, all right? So we can use a VPN, or we can actually go we can go to multiple clients. You can define up to 256 clients that you can connect to. So that could be, you'd have developers distributed around and you connect to, you know, different locations. Or you can just bring a VPN into your corporate network. Let's go for the VPN into the corporate network. And I'm gonna say, specify a new local network. So next job on there, and what it's asking me for, it's the site-to-site connectivity. So we'll give it a name, MyNet. And I can go, I need a public IP address for it, so 144.19.27.10, something like that. And the address space is where I'm going to be. So 10.80.0.0. This is my corporate network, And what we'll do is we'll get a slash 16 on there. If we can find slash 16, come on. There we go. So that's the address range for my corporate network. We can add more and more and more, okay? And we can add additional address spaces. So next on there, and then this is my virtual network in the cloud. So what would I like it to be? So I'm gonna go in here, 10.20, and we'll give that a slash 16, which has got subnet 1, call that ADNet, and you, that is .10, so we need a slash 24 on there. And you can see the process. You basically, and you know, this great thing is, you think, oh, IT pros won't be needed anymore. Now we've got the cloud. You will. You'll have to be designing your networks and everything else. So I can add multiple subnets in here. And then finally, what I'd need to do is I need to actually add a gateway subnet. So I need to define where the gateway is going to be sitting. And that completes that process. If you go to, if just to show you Net 101, if I look at the dashboard on that, it's actually connected down to, it's actually disabled at the moment. The VPN is disabled on-prem, and that's why it says connecting. But the really great thing about it is having defined it, you can then download a VPN device script. This is for your end. This is for your VPN. So you've got some different Cisco appliances, and then you've got some different Juniper appliances. And then this came out, oh, I don't know, a few months ago, you got a Microsoft appliance. You can actually use Windows Server 2012 to connect to. So this is your on-prem VN termination is 2012. And you just click on there, and what happens? It says, oh, here you go. There's the script to configure your end, all right? And actually, I know lots of people that have configured all sorts of things on-prem, TMG, etc. And they've just basically downloaded one of these scripts, seen what needs to be set up, and done it themselves. All right, so it makes it very, very easy to actually set this up. And finally, what I'll show you is I've got WebFarm. This is where I have my different, so if I look at the configuration on that, I've got down here, I've got different subnets. Now, as I say, you do not know what your DNS server address is going to be until you've deployed your VM. So here, after I deployed my VM, I picked up the IP address of the VM, and then what I did is I created a DNS server that I could then put on the network. Right? And the way you create a DNS server is you go new, register a DNS server, and you give it a name, and you give it an IP address. But I'll talk more about that in 1 second. Okay, so that gets us our virtual network. And to deploy the VM, what actually happens is you need your OS and your data in your blob storage. How do you get it there? Well, what you could do is you could take it from on-prem and copy it up there. The other alternative is having you could actually use and create from gallery. There's a gallery of virtual machines. So you've got 2012 data center and other bits and pieces. So I can create it from gallery and then attach my VM will be created from this gallery image. So it's up to you. If you like to copy it up there, absolutely fine. If you want to create it and from the gallery, you can do it, and you don't have to copy any data. Okay, now, this is very, very important. When you deploy a VM, it will go into what's referred to as a cloud service. Right? So there will be a cloud service supported for that VM, or created to support that VM. The cloud service has a public URL. Right? I put this VM onto VNet, but it also has a public URL to get to it. And there is a mapping here. So from that VIP over there, what it does is it will map the public port 57974 to 3389. The reason it needs to do port mapping is that if I deploy multiple VMs into that cloud service, they have a single public URL to all those VMs, so single IP. So what to be able to remote desktop to them all, well, I need to differentiate them in some other way, so the public actual port number is different, but then they're mapped using this mapping. Now, you might throw your hands up in horror and say, I don't want anyone getting at my VMs from a public URL. Fine. Then delete the endpoints, but then make sure you've got some other way of getting at them, right? And this is why you can use this concept of putting a jump server up there. So you have a jump server. If this is a cloud-only environment, you can't come to it from your corp net, so you can put a jump server up there, have a public URL to your jump server, log into the jump server, and then access all your other servers that are up there. Now, to be able to have VMs in an availability set, they must be deployed into the same cloud service. So what I could do is I could deploy one VM and then another VM, and they'd be in two separate cloud services, right? But I can't put them in an availability set. So they could end up next to each other on the same rack, or even next to each other on the same server if I'm using, you know, a small core. The address allocation is a little bit tricky. And it's like DHCP, right? It's dynamically allocated, but it exists for the lifetime of the service. So what we've got is we've got a VIP assigned to the cloud service. So this is our public IP, right? And there's a URL for it. As long as that cloud service exists, that will remain, right? If you delete the cloud service, that address could be allocated to someone else, right? The IPs for your VM are dynamically allocated at deployment time, and they will remain there through service healing as long as the VM remains, they will remain there. Trouble is, if you shut down the VM, as in Windows Azure shut down of the VM, and then start it again, the IP potentially changes. And never change an IP or a DNS address on a VM. So if you say, oh, look, I've got my VM, I know where my DHCP server is, what I'll do is I'll set all my client machines to use that. What will happen on service healing, they will actually get changed. So what we're doing is we're defining our subnet, and it's like a DHCP server has been set up for that subnet. And then we define a DNS server in the network definition, and it's like we've set up the DNS entry in DHCP. So to specify the DNS server, the IP address of the DNS server can't be specified when you do the network definition, because you don't know what the address will be, right, until the deployment's happened. So if you're deploying a cloud-only service, then you deploy the first domain controller on VNet, read its IP address, create a DNS server definition, and then every other VM that's brought up will have the correct DNS definition in it. Right. Previously, it wasn't actually possible to do that, which was an absolute nightmare. And I'll tell you today that the very first VM you deploy on a subnet will have a host identifier of 4. Right? So you could, and the workaround was to actually set your DNS to whatever your subnet address was, .4. And it all worked beautifully. But at some stage, Microsoft may change the very first address allocated on a subnet from .4. So at the moment, today, it's still .4, but in the future, it may change. If you're deploying a hybrid AD, then you set the VNet configuration with a DNS server set to the IP address of an on-premise DNS, right? So when your very first server comes up, it points DNS to on-premises, right? And then you can do your DC promo of this guy, and he'll all be happy. And then you deploy, you can then, once you've deployed him, you can read his IP address, right? And then you can create your DNS definition. So anyone else coming up will get on-prem and will also get the Azure subnet DNS definition. How do you deploy ADDS? Well, any way you like, basically. You could actually create a new domain controller on-premises and then upload the VHDs, right? You could use install from media, right? So you could create an IFM seed and do that. You could do a DC promo and replicate all your traffic across the VPN if you wanted to. You know, with a small AD, you could do that. If it's a huge AD, perhaps not the best thing to do. But the sort of option one, option two, it's pretty much the same, actually, in terms of performance. Now, this is, I put the slide in especially because this is actually important. The VM shutdown start DNS. When VM shut down from the portal, remember the VM is deallocated. When you restart the VM, it will be allocated a new internal address, all right? And if you've deallocated everything out of a cloud service, all right, the cloud service will have gone as well, and you will get a new VIP as well. So you could say, actually, what I'm going to do is I'm going to keep one VM running to keep the cloud service there. So that's another option. You know, this worry about doing a non-authoritative or making an authoritative restore sysfol. You could say, actually, do you know what we'll do? We'll always have one DC running and leave it running all the time. And that would get around that problem. So what you'll need to do is validate the VNet DNS servers when you start your deployment environment. So if you go from shutdown to start, you need to validate it. Trick that works today is that if I've deployed DC1, DC2, DC3, shut them all down. If I start DC1, start DC2, start DC3, they'll all have the same IP address they had previously. First one will be at 4, next one will be at 5, next one will be at 6 as a host identifier. Again, I can't guarantee that, you know, when you start it, it will always start, the first one will always be at 4. But today, that's the case. So what I want to do is actually, in the last few minutes, just go through the actual creation of a VM and looking at my DCs that exist up there. So if we just go back to here, and we go up to the virtual machines. So I've got my virtual machines, DC1. Let's have a look at this guy. If we look at the dashboard of DC1, what we'll see is he has a public virtual IP, or public VIP. That's his public, let's just do this for those at the back. So we've got the DNS, so that's our public DNS, and that's our public. And there, this guy was deployed first, and there's, he's got a .4. Right, so he's got a .4 on there. So that's the DC. And if we look at the endpoints on this DC, again, let's just bring that forward. What we can see here is that I've actually got PowerShell remoting coming in, but also remote desktop. So I've got in here a public port which maps to the appropriate private port. And the reason I need that mapping is because this is within a cloud service and I could have multiple DCs in there, so I need that port mapping. If you don't want those endpoints, because you say, I don't want anyone getting, you know, I don't want it exposed to the internet, just turn them off. That's fine, provided you've got some other method of getting to them. Now, let's go and let's just go through the process of creating a virtual machine, and we'll go from gallery. And look at that, you can even create a 2012 R2 preview. Let's just go with a 2012 data center for the moment. And you give it a name, DC3, and a username, and you go, oh, I have admin. And it comes up and says, you can't have admin. So I say, okay, I have root. And it prevents you using all those common names like administrator, etc. So we use AD admin, right? And so next on there. Now, the important thing is, if I go for a standalone, it's going to put it in a new cloud service. So what I need to do is say connect to an existing machine. And DC1 and DC2 are currently in this particular cloud service. So I'm going to put it in the VMs are going to go into that storage account. Because I'm going into an existing cloud service, it's got to be web farm as my virtual network, and then I can decide where to put it on that virtual network. Next on there, and now I can choose to join the web farm AD availability set. If I didn't choose to put it in the same cloud service, I would not be able to put it in the same availability set. So it's really important that you do that. And if we just cancel that, and let's just have a look at the cloud services and look at that. And we look at the dashboard on here. And what we can see on the cloud services, let's just do that again, is we've got the input endpoints to that cloud service. So the cloud service has a single VIP and then all the mapping. So I've got the mapping for DC1, which will take, and these are the endpoints will map into remote PowerShell and also map into remote desktop. Okay, let's just have a look. Finally, let's go over to virtual machines again. Let's go to jump one and go to the dashboard. And now I'm going to connect up to my jump server. As long as it's there, it might be going through service healing. All that looks good. So I'm now jumping up to or connecting to my jump server. And what I'll be able to do from there is actually I can manage my whole of my infrastructure up there. And this network seems to be horrendously slow. Come on. And the advantage of doing this, of course, especially if we're using 2012, is that we can bring everything into a consolidated view. So there's DC1, DC2. If I want to do something, oh, look, it's got a restart pending on it. Oh, so is my jump server. Okay, maybe I should have gone to jump 2. But hopefully we'll be all right. I can go and add roles, et cetera. So if you're not familiar with the 2012 sort of unified single administration point, do have a look at it because it's amazingly useful. There's the services that are running. I can stop start services on DC1, for instance. I can look at the events on DC1. I can look at the best practice analyzer and I can set performance counters and just switch between my computers. So there's a real advantage of actually using this for managing all your VMs up there. Or you could be starting to look at something like System Center to achieve it. So in 1 hour, 15 minutes, I hope I've given you a really good flavor of how to run Windows AD or WAD in virtual machines. But don't forget WAD for authentication and maybe thinking about federation. And particularly with the move to server 2012 R2, there's some very interesting things around the web application proxy that it's all going to be about federation, integrating with the Windows Azure directory, device objects. All right, so you can do your workplace joins and so on. So do think about that. And as always, if you want any help, you can always email me, or I'm always available for consultancy. So I'd like to bring the session to a close, spot on time, which is great. And thank you all for coming along. Thank you.